Bernie Moreno is looking out for himself, not us. Moreno is totally out of touch, and his company has a history of discriminating against its own workers. Moreno has even faced multiple lawsuits for racial discrimination. One black man sued for being told, "You black men out there tried to hide your criminal records," and being passed over for less qualified white applicants. Moreno has shown his colors. If he's elected senator, he's liable to rubber stamp Trump's radical Project 2025 agenda 100% and turn back the clock for Ohio. From taking away our overtime pay to gutting our public schools and rolling back our civil rights, we can't let Moreno take us backwards. We can count on Sherrod Brown to continue doing what's right to protect Ohio's workers and families. Register to vote by October 7th at OhioVoterGuide.org and re-elect Sherrod Brown.
Paid for by Ask Me People, AskMePeople.org, which is responsible for the content of this ad, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
When you need to work quickly and confidently across different apps and platforms, consistent quality communication is key. Whether you're writing documents, emails, or presentations, you need Grammarly. It's an AI writing partner that helps you get your work done faster with better writing. It's always there to help because it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can get more done no matter where you're writing. Grammarly is the gold standard of responsible AI, trusted by millions of professionals for 15 years. It gives you personalized writing suggestions based on your audience, goals, and context, plus tone suggestions to help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Good morning and welcome to the 98th episode of the Jaguar Report podcast. Hey, I got to say a good morning this time. 98 episodes, I think that's a first.
Good morning. Is it really? You've probably done one or two without me, though. Did you say good morning then?
I think so, to keep the bit going. There you go. It's the first time I've been allowed to say good morning under your iron fist.
That's right. I don't know if I really allowed it. You just kind of went for it, but it's cool.
Yeah, no. It felt good. It felt good. It felt natural, honestly, even if it is 3:15 in the afternoon.
Yeah. Don't worry about that.
Yeah. With that said, welcome to the Jaguar Report podcast, episode number 98, guess. Who would have thought?
Who would have thought? Certainly not.
Who would have thought?
Every other episode we say that, but...
This podcast sincerely has gone about 95 episodes longer than I thought it would. So good for us. But we are here, obviously, to recap the 2024 Jaguars draft class. 9 picks this year, Gus. A godsend compared to the 13 players we had to write up last year.
Yeah.
I was like straight up mad last year. Like, you know, I could care less who they pick, et cetera, but I was mad that they made 13 selections last year. So I was a little cooled off this year, even though 9 is still a little... too much for my liking, but it's all right.
I know. When they got that one extra pick this year, it was like, really? It is nice that they got two.
I feel like if
they had traded back in the first round and gotten 3 picks in this year's draft, I definitely would have been upset. Last year, I didn't think too much of it, only because it was like my first year. Like, I got full time pretty much like 2 weeks before the draft. So I was just scrambling around trying to cover it. And didn't know any better, really, how much 13 was. But 13 was pretty insane.
Yeah, it was brutal. So never again. It also, I've learned that, I've said it before, people who cover teams are like picking the top 5, top 10, have it much better off than those picking later on in the draft. Imagine a year where they pick like 30th. That'd be brutal, dude.
Yeah.
Hit me over the head with a mallet. Don't let that out.
Here's to the Jags never going to the Super Bowl for our sakes.
Well, with that said, I know the fans have been clamoring for a recap podcast. Sorry we didn't get it out yesterday. Had something to do on my end. You can take it out on me on Twitter like so many ought to do.
Yeah, I was going to do that anyway.
I'll just start off with this, guys. I got absolutely killed for posting the consensus board.
I know. I was just happy to just kind of like click retweet, not even add a little opinion.
I'm gonna do it every year now. Like, I should have started doing it last year, and it would have been the same reaction.
Anything for engagement, Shipley, huh?
Literally, I'm posting no commentary of my own. I'm just saying, hey, Here's what this data set looks like. And the main reason I posted it, too, was to get people to prepare for, like, you can tell based on how they pick my consensus board what draft grades are going to look like. I've seen, like, Jags fans confused why so many draft grades have them, like, in the bottom, like, five or six. And look at the consensus board. That like, because that's how you get graded. It's like what Nick Wright said about Howie Roseman. Everybody always says he wins the draft because he mostly picks, like, the guys, you know, more or less at the top of the board. Yeah.
No, yeah. That's true. It's tough to, like, gauge, like, just, like, the whole grading of drafts, because obviously we need to have, like, some kind of grade immediately and can't only look at it in hindsight. Like, there's got to be some way to, like, grade the process. And that just happens to be, like, the best, I don't know, material way to grade the process, or the best thing to be able to point at or pull from or whatever. And so it's definitely not a perfect metric. But, I mean, no such thing as a perfect metric, at least when it comes to football. Yeah. And so, like, there's, and like all the other metrics out there, like, there's plenty of context that you, like, need. Like, Mason Smith was, there was definitely a lot of reaches for the Jags in the draft, but I think Mason Smith was probably, like, the least egregious, despite what, like, the numbers might say, because, like, there was no way he was going to get out of the second round, regardless of what big boards might have said. Plus the fact that he's, like, such a good team fit in Jacksonville, just, like, makes it a little bit better. If he had gone somewhere, like, that just, like, made no sense for him, where he probably wasn't going to be able to get the chance to, like, develop with a good defensive coach, then, like, then you could, like, grade it poorly. But when you get context a little bit behind it, then, I don't know. Like I said, it's just, like, other metrics. It's a nice thing to point at and pull from, but you still need context. But, like, that's kind of what we're at right now in terms of, like, just NFL draft grades, because we got to be able to – I don't know, analyze it now and not just wait until we know if players are good or not.
No, 100%. And as much as people say they hate grades before a player hits the field, the numbers don't reflect that. It is consistently one of the most read stories every single year, least on our site. So, and, you know, I'm with you. I don't think the consensus board is, like, a Bible to go by. And I'm actually higher on the Jaguars draft than the consensus board is. Mm-hmm. I feel like I said that multiple times throughout the weekend, and I was still getting, like, slaughtered. Somebody, like, asked me if I was done, like, doomsday scrolling, and I'm like, what are you talking about, dude? I said I like the pick. I'm just
– I saw in multiple group chats on Twitter and via, like, iMessage, Shipley hates the Jaguars.
It's my fault, I guess, for thinking people could read.
I don't know. I think there's fault in definitely in both directions. You should know. Yeah. You should have known better, but, like, it's definitely not all your fault either.
I both got accused of being too much of a hater and being a company man. So I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure what I could have done. I'm really not. But nonetheless,
yeah,
that's, you know. And last thing I'll say on that: one fan did tweet out the Jags picks by and compare it to, like, the difference in consensus board the last two drafts. Just saying, the data reflects that they weren't great drafts at the time, and everybody hates those drafts now. But I will say I'm higher on this draft than consensus. Let's get rolling, Gus. We had a whole episode about Brian Thomas Jr. and the first round process, so we won't go too much into that. I recommend everybody listen to that for our full takes. I had a floor ceiling take in there, but I do think it's worth talking about it a little bit more right now after today's news of they released former starting wide receiver Zay Jones. Yeah, to me, it was, like, one of the most telegraphed moves possible. Like, you don't keep a guy as a fourth receiver who doesn't play special teams and pay him $10 million. Like, there's no NFL team that's doing that, like, in the history of the league. And to the point of, well, who's going to play receiver now if the Jaguars get injuries? Yeah, they'd be screwed. So would every team in the NFL. There is no team keeping four starting quality wide receivers on their roster. I'd love for somebody to find that team. Have people seen the Eagles wide receiver depth chart after, like, Devonta Smith and A.J. Brown? Like, it's terrible.
It's same for the Bengals. I mean, they just got Jermaine Burton. I don't know which round it was, but, like, it's the same for the Dolphins. Like, you either have, like, one or two great guys and then a bunch of scrubs, or, like, you just have, like, all complete – mid, like the Patriots. Like, the Patriots have, like, five or six receivers who, like, could see the field, but, like, is definitely not a number one or two option. And then there's teams like the Jaguars in the middle where they have, like, two or three really nice options, but not really a star player. And I don't know, after the Zay Jones cut, like now Devin Duvernay is their wide receiver four. And so it's kind of the same situation they were in last year.
He's like unquestionably the receiver four, right? Like the Parker Washington stuff has jumped the shark. Like as little as people might think of Devin Duvernay, like before this past season where he caught like four passes, his worst year is better than what Parker Washington produced last year.
Yeah,
he's a better receiver.
Maybe if like Christian Kirk specifically missed a few games, then Parker Washington would be able to like find a role. But just in general, for sure, like Devin Duvernay is a wide receiver four. And I would for sure expect him to rank fourth among receivers in snaps and catches and all the other stats.
Yeah, I'm with it. Which would mean receiver spots five and six, maybe seven, since they carried seven last year. You know, be a battle between Parker Washington, Elijah Cooks, Tim Jones, and four undrafted wide receivers. I think Josh Cephas is obviously the biggest name. You know, a lot of good buzz about him coming out from the Shrine Bowl. I think most predicted he'd be a late day three pick. So, I mean, in terms of undrafted free agency, I think they got two guys who should have been draft picks between him and Ohio State safety Josh Proctor. So,
right.
It's funny if they actually picked those two guys instead of some of the guys they picked. They get higher grades for, you know, it's funny how that works out. But so
yeah, that's true.
It felt obvious they would be released because when you select a guy like Thomas, who, again, a big reason you're taking him is what he does for the rest of the offense just by having his presence on the field alone. That can open things up underneath. That can open things up for the running game. It can change safety alignment. It like showed to me, like, you have to have this guy on the field. You know, he cannot be rotating snaps with Zay Jones. And unfortunately, if you're not a receiver, top three receiver, you have to play some kind of special teams. And Zay Jones just didn't. So the Zay Jones era has ended in Jacksonville. So 2 years of Zay Jones after like a 3-year, $24 million contract. I don't think they're going to post student first in. I'm not sure, but I don't think they are because they should just eat all the dead cap now instead of splitting it over the next 2 years. Do you have any take on his tenure in Jacksonville? Like, do you consider it a good signing now, a couple years down the road?
I wouldn't say good is the right word, since he didn't reach the end of his contract or get extended or re-sign or whatever.
Well, like most free agents don't.
I know, I guess you're right. That was just like my first instinct of like how to judge whether a contract is good is if they at least get to the end of it, even if they don't re-sign. But he was cut after 2 years, even though it was originally a 3-year deal. And I think he might have been restructured last year to maybe it only added like 1 year and a couple board years. But I mean, he had a pretty good season last year. He set career highs across the board, which is good for him. But he also had like the team's longest play from scrimmage of the season with the 59-yard touchdown against the Cowboys. And so he had three touchdowns in that game. He had a big touchdown against the Chargers in the comeback. And so he had a nice season and a couple big moments. But then his injury kind of like low-key is the one that tanked the Jaguars. Because obviously once Christian Kirk and Trevor Lawrence got hurt at the end of last year, then it was like officially over. But not having Zay Jones really hurt them and what they wanted to do with like kind of having Calvin Ridley slowly get acclimated to the offense. And then all of a sudden Calvin was just asked to do a lot more stuff that Zay was supposed to be doing. So, yeah, a pretty good year and then a pretty forgettable year. So, overall, like.
Yeah, like I think you can pin last year on injuries completely.
Yeah.
I think his 22 season wasn't good. I do not think he was good in 2022. He had 121 targets and turned it into 823 yards. I mean, he's only gotten over 100 targets twice in his career. And it was probably a reason, you know. So, I think his perception kind of got overrated by fans because he got fed the ball so much that year that it kind of inflated people's opinions. He just never was efficient. So, I don't know. I still kind of think maybe they would have been better off if they took, like, a receiver in the second round that year instead of paying him. But, I mean, they got some memorable moments out of it. He was a good guy, you know, in the locker room and, you know, around the team and stuff. I will say a lot of people have asked why didn't they just trade him. People I've talked to, they tried. They were shopping him throughout the offseason before the draft and even after they picked Brian Thomas Jr. And just nobody's taken on, you know, $10 million to Zay Jones in 2024. So people, for those who have asked why didn't they just trade him, they absolutely tried. I believe they would have taken like a day three 2026 pick for him, but it never got offered. So it's odd how the thing that was holding together the Brandon Ayuk trade wasn't actually valued by the team.
Well, I feel like the plan for the Jags was obviously they wanted to keep Calvin. And so I think as soon as Calvin signed a contract with the Jags, hypothetically, they would have kind of cut Zay on the spot and have it been kind of like a one-for-one roster move. And then when Calvin kind of surprised them and moved on to Tennessee, they just kind of kept him around for insurance, essentially, and just waited until they like secured a replacement for Calvin in Brian Thomas Jr. before cutting him. So it was definitely not a surprising move.
Do you mean this doesn't mean Jarvis Landry's becoming a Jaguar?
I was about to say that, but I was like, you know what? He hasn't been mentioned so far. I feel like we're probably just going to not mention his name on purpose.
Oh, brother.
I guess we're going to talk about it.
Oh, brother. Maybe he gets a contract after the tryout, but
yeah,
way too many tweets out there about somebody who genuinely is not even under contract. So it, oh, brother.
I wouldn't be surprised if he like had a decent mini camp tryout or whatever and then signed a contract, but I would be beyond shocked if he made the 53-man roster.
Yeah, no, I'm with you completely on that one. So end of the day, the Brian Thomas selection had a lot of ramifications for Jaguars. In my grading, you know, I gave it an A-. I think a lot of that has to do with the process, trading down. They now have 6 picks in the top 4 rounds next year, which is fantastic, especially if they want to trade for a veteran at any position. They now have that ammo. They now have the draft capital to be flexible. And if they don't, then you have 6 super valuable picks next year. So A- for me. What's your grade on the Thomas pick?
I did immediate grades over the weekend for 10-10. My immediate grade was a B-. And after thinking about it for a day or three, I'd probably bring it up to like a B or maybe even a B+. But I'm just like not sold enough on Thomas. And it's not that I don't like Thomas. It's just that like, I don't know, like I think he could end up being DJ Chark. And so like I wouldn't want to give an A grade unless it's for a prospect that I'm like really sold on. But since I haven't actually like dove into him, I feel like I said this on the podcast we did on him specifically too. I certainly think it was an above average night for Jacksonville for sure, but I'm just not giving it a super high grade until later.
Yep. That makes sense. The one thing I will give the Jaguars credit for was that I felt like I was saying all process. You can get a receiver in the second, you can get a receiver in the third, and it doesn't look like it actually worked out like that. So three receivers went in the first round after Thomas, and then the second round started with 3 receivers in the top 5 picks. So the only receivers that would have been available at 48 consist of Adonai Mitchell, who went at 52. He's kind of like a similar player to Thomas on the field, but I mean, everybody saw the buzz that Chris Ballard went on and on about. I have to presume, as much as like the Bob McKinn articles do suck, that there's a reason like one of the most athletic receivers in football slid to the second round, but yeah, we'll see on that one. So Mitchell is maybe the one case you can make maybe they should pick somebody else in the first and a receiver in the second. Because otherwise, no other receiver went in the second. Malachi Corley went top of the third. Not a fit at all. Jermaine Burden went in the third. You know, I love him as a player, but let's get real. Him going to the Bengals is like the perfect like thing. You know, he's a very Bengal type player. You know, nobody knows what's going to happen with him. Roman Wilson to Steelers 84. He wasn't really option. Jalen McMillan, another like slot type guy. Luke McCaffrey. Troy Franklin didn't go until the fourth. And then after that, like it's like Troy Franklin, Javon Baker, and Devontae Walker all went in the fourth. And other than that, I don't think there's any receivers that like really mattered. So they were probably right on how they evaluated that position.
Yeah. I think Brian Thomas is probably their guy for a while, like pretty much since the like Ridley walked. I think they were like, okay, we had already like had our eye on Thomas Jr., but now he might be kind of target number one because of like they might have had a sense of how those receivers are going to go. And I feel like a lot of receivers, especially in like the top of the second range, were pretty overdrafted. But I mean, so were quarterbacks, and so that's just kind of the way the league is trending. And so it was definitely wise and like had good foresight for the Jaguars to get a receiver while they could. I think that's why they were doing so much homework on Tez Walker now that the draft is over, is because I think like Brian Thomas was plan A, and then if they ended up leaving the first round without him, then like they really wanted a speed guy. Like they Peterson for sure, and I think Balky too, both talked about like how important speed was specifically to, in order to stretch the field and create space. And Tez is probably like the best pure speed guy. Like he's like this class's Marquise Brown, basically, where he's can take the top off, but he's not like Brian Thomas, where he has like potential to grow into even more than that. So
yeah,
I feel like Tez Walker was plan B for them.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think the Tez Walker thing was so funny, man. They put so much like time scouting him, but it made sense to me why they didn't double dip at receiver, even though they had the chance to in the fourth round. So I think we can move on to the next one. Pick number 48, second round pick, Mason Smith, defensive tackle, LSU. First things first, Gus bodied me. You know, I'll just make this clear. Gus toe tagged me. Gus told me he was going to go high. I, like the sheeple that I am, didn't listen to him, read too many mocks and stuff. Even Dane Brugler, I think, said like the day of day two or a couple days before the draft, somebody asked him, they're like, don't you think Smith could go higher than people think because of his frame and athleticism? And Brugler was like, yeah, he could sneak into the top 50. So I don't think that many people should be surprised. I was wrong, Gus. For the record, our bet is right down the middle because my mock draft destroyed yours. So nobody's wearing a Hawaiian shirt. You were right. There is no scenario where Mason Smith would have left round two, let alone get to 96 overall. I mean, that kind of frame, that kind of athleticism, that kind of movement skills, you're going to hear the comparisons and you're going to hate it. But it's very Chris Jones-like. It just is. Look at Chris Jones's measurables and look at his production from Mississippi State and tell me what's so different. The difference is obviously that Jones has developed like marvelously since he was drafted by Kansas City. I'd say Jones had better tape too. I watched like three games of Mason Smith from 2018 and then watched a game of Chris Jones in his final year. It's not fair because it's Chris Jones in his final year versus a freshman, but Jones should have been like a top 10 pick. I'm watching it, obviously, in the hindsight, knowing he turned into Chris Jones, but he was like blowing plays up like consistently. Real. And if you go back and look at the scouting reports, the reasons he dropped to the second or maturity didn't produce enough for a big prospect like he was, et cetera, et cetera. More or less the same things, you know, you hear on this end. So I want to preface this by saying I'm not saying he's going to become Chris Jones, but. I see the vision, man. I think he's either going to be Robert Nkendiche, the guy the Cardinals took who from Ole Miss who was terrible. I think he's either going to be that or he's going to be a Chris Jones-level Pro Bowl player. The movement skills and the frame from the three technique position, you don't find those guys very often in the draft. He has legitimately good tape from 2021. That, of course, was 3 years ago. And that's probably why he was at 48 and not in the first round with all the tools that he has, was because the last 2 years have basically been useless for him. He, you know, tore his ACL early, like 10 plays into 2022. And then last year, he was both recovering, and you could also, in my opinion, tell he was kind of just trying to get through the season, like, alive, so he could, you know, like, declare. Yeah. So, not a lot of snaps the last 2 years. He has a long way to go in his development, but I'll say, I guess, I see the vision, and I also think I feel like that's the pick they've been killed for the most. I don't think it's even close to their worst pick. And two, it's not even the worst pick an AFC South team made for a defensive tackle in the second round. Taking Devondre Sweat at 38.
That was crazy.
That's miles worse. Because, okay, even if you don't account for Sweat's like off-field stuff, fine. Mm-hmm. What upside is there? He is a 360-pound nose tackle. He is offering you zero, zip, zilch, nada as a pass rusher. Yeah. Why are you taking that dude 38 overall? So it's been interesting to me to see the Jags killed so much for taking Smith, where I'm like, and the Titans made a significantly worse pick at the same position and early. But that's my take on it. I gave it a B-. I'll say it. I'm a Mason Smith fan. I like the traits. I like the tape before he got hurt. I think that pairing him with Ryan Nielsen is a pretty good proposition. He's like one of the premier defensive line coaches. I know he's not going to be his position coach, but just having his influence. So I don't think it was that egregious of a selection.
Yeah, I think all that is fair. First of all, you don't have to apologize to me. You just have to apologize to Matt Miller.
But, oh, brother.
I'm actually mad at myself because, like, I've been calling defensive tackle or defensive line in round two for a couple of weeks now. But, like, I just did not identify Mason Smith at all as a fit, even though I definitely should have. I guess I don't even know what it was. I just didn't know enough about him, I guess. And so I should have done a deeper dive on all the prospects at the position. But I definitely wasn't surprised to see the pick in terms of, like, Mason Smith and defensive tackle and all the traits and the LSU line and all that stuff. But I gave it a C flat, which is for two reasons, basically. One is just that he's such a boom-bust prospect, I feel like. Like, Thomas Jr. is also boom-busty, but it's like, his ceiling is wide receiver one, and his floor is probably wide receiver three. But for Mason Smith, his ceiling is like Chris Jones, sure. But then his floor is probably like not
on the NFL
years. Yeah, exactly. And so, like, just because, again, like, I didn't have enough conviction for Thomas to give him an A. And so I don't have enough conviction for Smith to give him a B. And so that's part of it. But also, like, I was just stunned that cornerback wasn't selected in the first 50 picks.
So Balky mentioned wanting to trade up. Drink, if you heard that before. Every day, too. Every day, too, he's going to say he wanted to trade up and nobody wanted to dance with him.
Yep.
I think he would have traded up for a corner. Because he had a quote, and I'll find it real quick, that made me think that. I think he would have traded up for Kool-Aid, maybe Max Melton, somebody along those lines. Because there was a corner run before, you know, they picked at 48. I'll pull up that draft order real quick. Yeah, corner. So there was both a defensive tackle run, you know, three defensive tackles taken in four selections. I think that definitely four taken in five. Jesus. I think that definitely influenced things. And then Cooper DeJean, Kool-Aid, Lassiter, and Max Melton going in four consecutive picks. I think that was a big reason why they ended up going, you know, defensive tackle. The next corner is off the board with Mike Sander still. You know, he's a really good nickel guy, and I don't think anybody would have complained. But Enos Wakestraw went off, Renardo Green. So those are the other corners that went in the second. You could make an argument, I think, for any of them. But it just seems like for the Jaguars, you know, they had specific corners in mind. And once it didn't land them, they were just kind of, you know, moving on. Okay, let me pull up. Okay. So Balky got asked about the corner run and the second. He said, you look historically at the draft in the second round. There's a run on corners usually. When they start coming, they come off quick. It wasn't something that was not expected. You look at things, you try to move. Sometimes you can move, sometimes you can't. Houston obviously wasn't going to trade their pick. The board is the board, and we felt really good about the players we got. And then he was asked as a follow-up if he felt the corner run was unlucky. And he said, no, we had Mason targeted as well. We have a need there as well. It's not like we didn't have any other needs other than corner. We have another day in this draft. So I think him saying we had Mason targeted as well is saying, like, they had Mason, like, in that cluster of players they wanted to pick. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's straight up admitting. He's like, Houston wouldn't be a team that would trade with us. To me, saying you had this guy targeted as well says that they were looking at corner, and it just didn't happen. And also him saying he doesn't think about the players he didn't draft, which to me screamed, okay, he's trying not to cope about not taking a corner.
That's right? Definitely what it was, for sure. Where did Houston pick in the second round?
They picked a few picks before the Jags. They picked 42. So that's when Lassiter and Melton came off the board. So Max Melton?
I mean, I would have been happy with Enos Wakestraw.
Enos.
I'm not personally a huge Enos Wakestraw, or I just assume.
Enos. What the hell?
I don't know. I don't know a lot about Renardo Green, but I know there's a lot of people out there that are fans of him. So I was kind of hoping / assuming one of those two guys was still going to be the pick, even if, like, Kool-Aid and Melon and some higher rated guys had just gone off the board.
So the biggest negative I think I'll say about the Smith pick is they did pass on some appealing options. You know, like, that was, I think, the point in the draft where they had a lot of guys that were still on the board that could have been interesting. Marshawn Nealon, Michael Hall Jr., Enos Wickshaw, Kingsley Suamatia, Roger Rosengarten, and Renardo Green. I think those all would have been good picks too. And they all probably would have been safer picks than Smith. I think. This is definitely a trades pick. I got texted from somebody on staff like after that pick was made immediately. It was just a two-word text. It said upside pick. It was like they were waiting for me to like text them and be like, what's going on with that? And they were just getting ahead of it.
I think it was a good upside pick, though, like with like the fit like you were talking about with Nielsen. And then, like, I don't know, just like this is the type of prospects that you take a swing on at this spot. And so I'll maybe move my grade up to a C+, slightly above average. But I'm still hanging out on the fence just because there's such a wide range of possibilities.
So what do we think? We think his role this year is just rotational, right? That's more snaps than their second round pick last year, but just rotational. They hope he shows enough that they can get out of the Robinson-Harris contract next offseason and maybe, you know, he's bumped up on the depth chart.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because they're not going to – like, there's no reason to be like, oh, hopefully we get out of the Arik Armstead deal next year. So, yeah, I think it makes sense to, like, kind of have a – I don't know. They seem to really like Roy, though. So, like, that makes sense to me on paper. But, like, I wouldn't be surprised if they just want to keep Roy around.
Yeah, I looked at the contracts. They don't have an out for Roy until next year, and they don't have an out for Devon Hamilton for another 2 years. So I've gotten a lot of people ask me about their other defense tackle pick, if that's an indictment on Devon Hamilton. I'm like, even if it is, like, he's literally – you can't put him off the roster for another couple of years. So it doesn't matter. So I think we're about the same wavelength on the Smith pick. I think it's definitely has some risk, but I also think it's – maybe the criticism has perhaps gone too far.
Yeah, I agree with that. I definitely would agree with what you said earlier, where there's like, I think there's been multiple other bigger reaches in the draft than Mason Smith.
Yeah, I honestly thought their next pick was a bigger one. So number 96 pick, third round, Jarian Jones, FSU corner at 96 overall. I want to preface this by saying I'm a fan of the player. You know, I don't have any like real negative things to say about the player. It's just to me, so I give it a C+. To me, it's about the process. I don't understand taking a nickel corner when there are other outside corners still available. You know, like Kyrie Jackson, who was one of the better like mid-tier press cornerback prospects in this class. Mm-hmm. If you take him and maybe take Jones at like 114 or 116, I think that looks So I agree that Jones is probably a little bit of a reach. Nobody had him like really in this like range in terms of mocks and stuff. I think Dan Brugler had him in the sixth round, which I don't agree with that grade, but I was listening to Athletic Show and he was like disgusted with this pick. I think this pick is better than that. I don't think it's a F-, what the hell are you doing, Quentin Strange type pick. You know what I mean? Because that was legitimately, you could say on the spot then, that is a bad draft pick. I don't think this is that. I just think the process of valuing a nickel corner over an outside corner was a bit odd. And maybe their copium is that they think he can play outside. I do not. Dude, FSU fans despised him until he got moved into the slot. He is a slot corner. Every corner, it feels like they ever take, they say he has inside-out versatility. It's rarely ever true. I don't think it's true in this case. I think he is a nickel and a nickel only. I think he's a good nickel. I think he has definitely some athletic traits that you can – that suggest that even though he's an older prospect with a lot of experience, that there's still some upside there since he's only really spent 1 year at the position, and he obviously tested very well. So I'm a fan of Jones as a player. I think he fits in well. I think it's a good thing that they – took a nickel corner at some point because it was still a need because, and I reiterate, Darnell Savage is not a nickel cornerback. So I think there's some positives to the pick. It's just, I keep coming back to, you really could have taken an outside corner here, you know?
No, we're all right on the same wavelength. I wrote down for this grade, I like Jones as a player. And then later I mostly gave the pick a mediocre grade for the Jaguars' process. And so it was the exact same thing where, like, they did need, like, a nickel because I feel like they're going to do the same thing they did late last season where it's, like, they're going to have Darnell Savage or maybe Antonio Johnson, one of the two, playing nickel on early downs, and then they'll have Jones come in on late downs kind of like Herndon did and be, like, the cover nickel, which seems pretty silly to me, but I'm not an NFL coach. Again, I agree with you where, like, if it was someone who truly had inside outside versatility or someone who was just outside only, I would have been much happier with this pick, because I feel like you can find nickels more often in the middle of day three, which is where Jones was expected to go. And so it was a little bit of a reach. And if it's, you're going to do a little bit of a reach on someone, I want it to be like a Mason Smith, or like, even if people don't think of defensive tackle as a premium position, like if you can get a pass rushing defensive tackle, then that's a premium position. And so that's worth taking a risk on in the in day two. But I didn't really think it was, this was worth the risk of taking likely a nickel only corner who's probably going to be like more of an impact on special teams than anything else, honestly. And like, so we talked on, I think it was the Brian Thomas Jr. show that we did, about how like Tyson Campbell is a free agent next offseason, and it wouldn't surprise us if like they end up just drafting his immediate successor in the first round, kind of like how they did with Thomas Jr. and Ridley this year, and then Anton Harrison and Jawan Taylor last year. And so I wrote, Monteric Brown remains a succession plan for Tyson Campbell at outside corner. I would have tried to find someone a little bit sooner in 2024, so that you're not kind of like scrambling in 2025 like you were the last two off seasons.
Yeah, and you're surprised, right, that they didn't attack the secondary harder. Like, I get why they made each of their first two picks. It is just it's surprising to me, especially with the change in scheme and how much they even said outright that they needed to attack it, that they
weren't aggressive.
Yeah.
Balky said it multiple times. He did say a couple times, too, that like he likes the depth. So he at least gave us the hint there, but like, I feel like the real hint was in the Nielsen presser when he was like, we got guys that can rush the passer, but we got to find guys who can cover. That's more paraphrasing, but.
And they can use the copium of, well, we drafted two, but did they really?
Hey, Marshawn Lattimore is still out there at least.
Yeah, that was a good call by you. And I'm with you. I did a 2025, like way too early mock, like just picking a first round player. I went corner because even if they were signed Tyson Campbell, I still think corner is probably going to be their biggest need.
Yeah.
If they re-sign one of the offensive tackles, that's not a need. So I think that corner is a need no matter what, whereas left tackle is a coin flip. I'm with you. I think next year we see the same strategy that we've seen the last 2 years, but it's either going to be a corner or left tackle. And my guess is it's going to be at corner. So it'll be interesting to see. All right, Gus. We're going to break real quick, and then we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the day three picks. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. Some news after the break. ESPN's Mike DeRocco said the Jaguars, shockingly, will not pick up Mac Jones' fifth-year option. Mm-hmm. The buzz definitely seems like they basically just want Mac Jones for this year and hope to maybe get a comp pick for him next year. So I will say it was a beautiful bit for the Patriots to take Joe Milton
that was a nice way to bring it all full circle.
It really was. But all right, we're back with the Jags draft class. We've gone through the first three picks. Now we're on to day three. Day three, I think we both kind of learned, is where under this regime, the Jaguars like to get pretty weird. And this year was no different. I think I'll start off by saying this. My takeaway on how Balky drafts after 4 years of covering is, I'm not sure he has a care in the world where other teams value anybody, right? Like, I think he just sees his board and that's it. And I'm not saying that as a compliment or a criticism. It's just when they make reaches, I think that's why. You know, like, he doesn't care if this guy will be available in the six because he doesn't care how other teams grade. He cares how his team grades. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think also, like, one takeaway that I had was that Balky has a small board, maybe. And by that, I mean, like, not a very big board. I think, who was that? I'm pretty sure it was John Lynch who said in a pre-draft presser this year that their team had 82 players on their board as, like, with draftable grades. And so, like, once, like, 60 or 70 players off the board, like, then, like, the Jags' board might have looked like Jordan Jefferson, Cam Little, a bunch of undrafted free agents. And so, like, I feel like their day three was just a fast pass to unrestricted or undrafted free agency. And so I think part of that is just because, like, they didn't have a lot of players graded as draftable. And so pretty quickly they were, like, looking at UDFA-type players.
Yeah. And like you and I have said before the draft, this draft basically cease to exist after like the fourth round. Sands, like a couple options. Did you catch, I think I don't know if it was NFL Network or ESPN, after they made their Keelan Robinson pick, they went to the Jags war room. It's just Tony Khan like going through that giant. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah, it was Tony Khan going through like a giant laminated thing, a bunch of colors, like color coded and everything. It seemed like he was like going through like their preferred like undrafted free agents, because that's what he does, you know, which to me kind of said it all about, you know, this draft class. But
yep.
We'll start round four, pick number 114, Missouri offensive tackle Javon Foster. He got linked to, I feel like on day three especially, maybe it's kind of easy to peg who their guys are. Tyler Lacy, we both like said last year how obvious it was they were interested in him. Javon Foster was the same thing. His name came up like multiple times during the process as somebody that they were interested in. I give it an A. I thought it was one of their best picks. I think that I'm a fan of his tape, and I legitimately, my belief on offensive tackle is, so like the Chargers to me played the draft perfectly because they took a premier tackle prospect at 5 overall, and then they got a receiver at 34 or 35, whatever you want to call it, in Ladd McConkey. If you reverse that and they take Malik Nabers, then they get who? Like what offensive tackle in the second round? You know, like it just, it's much better to draft tackles early because tackles simply do not fall down the board that far. So I'm a believer that if you want to draft a starting tackle, you need to draft them early, which to me is what makes this pick, in my opinion, a steal. I know it's not a steal by the consensus board or whatever, but look at some of like the like value, like offensive line evaluators and stuff. Everybody you talk to is a Foster fan. He has swing tackle versatility. He's played left tackle. He's played right tackle. He has a ton of snaps in the SEC. He's another like older prospect, which they took some like 24-year-olds in this class. They said beforehand it was an older class, which it is, but he has swing tackle versatility. And he's one of the few day three tackles who you can say has a legitimate starter upside. And that's not to say that's your future left tackle right there, but he has a chance. He legitimately has a chance. And to me, to take a player in the fourth round that at worst is a swing tackle and at best can potentially start for you at one or two tackle spots, I think that's a good pick. And we talked about it. They had to take a tackle at some point because they have two tackles on expiring deals. So I thought it was a good pick.
Yeah. Brandon Thorne called Foster an ideal development pick who can be groomed into contributor over time. So that's kind of like what everyone said, is that like, even though he's an older prospect with a lot of experience, almost similar to Jerrion Jones, where he still has a little bit of untapped potential in his game. And so it makes a lot of sense to get him now and then have them learn from Cam Robinson and Phil Rauscher and like hopefully fingers crossed, like not play at all as a rookie, because that means there weren't a lot of injuries in 2024, and then like be just not the option, but a option to be a starter at tackle. And I think he even, like, it seems like the Jags' plan for him is definitely swing tackle, and then we'll go from there. And I think that's fair. But, like, I've also seen some stuff that suggests that he could be a guard. So I think he's got a little bit of versatility to him. I graded it B. It was definitely easily, like, the best pick I thought they had outside of the first round. And I think even with Brian Thomas, like, those two were probably my favorites that they had. It just makes a lot of sense, and I think it was a good value getting him where they did.
I really don't have any like negatives to say about this pick, honestly. I thought it was a smart process that identified, you know, a good prospect. He in my opinion, I know he wasn't like on the consensus, he was fourth round value. I think he should have gone in the round three, because like
some other tackles went earlier too. Like, yeah. Brandon Coleman went a little bit earlier than I thought. Blake Fisher went a little bit earlier than I thought. Roger Rosengarten. Some people said he's going to get pretty early, but he went a little bit earlier than I thought. And so for them to still be able to get Foster in the fourth, like with the way that the draft went specifically.
And like for context, the next offensive tackle taken after him was like 20 picks later. And it was that dude from the British Columbia who, you know, like is a complete.
No one I've ever heard of.
Yeah, exactly. So. Not exactly, you know, strong point for tackles. And I don't know, you go to the end of the third round, some of these, so there's a tackle run between the third round and the second round. I would take Foster's tape over Blake Fisher's. Rosengarten, I think, is probably, he went two rounds earlier. you know, but I think he's a better prospect. Sua Matia, I thought, was a first-round prospect. I would take Foster's tape over Brandon Coleman's, who went 67 to Washington. I take it over Caden Wallace, who went 68 to New England. I'm not going to try to pronounce the Yale offensive tackle's name, but I'd probably put them about even, the one the Bears took. I would take him over Gus Logue mocked player Delmar Glaze, who went middle of the third round. And I take him over the Pittsburgh tackle that the Colts took. So I thought this was some of their best value of the draft, honestly.
There you go. Yeah, I feel like we're on the similar wavelength for both this pick and the Mason Smith pick. Yeah. You're just like both guys a little bit more than I do. And I don't – like, I'm just kind of trying to be as neutral as I can about the players themselves.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. You're a tough cookie to crack.
I'm going to be a tough grader because no one else in local media is.
Hey! Yeah! He's got claws.
No.
Well, I was here.
This one's a B. This one's a C. And Mia's like A minus, A, B plus. I'm like, ah, something like I can't. We can't have two people like that giving out.
After the kicker was picked, your grade for that got read out loud. The room killed it.
Really?
Killed you for it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They killed you. I stood with you.
There we go.
I
haven't heard or seen one other person with the same take as me that it was not a good pick, but we'll get there when we get there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right. Moving on. Two picks later, 116. So a bunch – basically national media was already calling the Jaguars draft pretty weird up to this point. Fair. By this pick, before they made this pick, I'm like, hey, they actually got a pretty decent haul. You know, maybe some reaches, but it looks like a decent haul.
Yeah.
This was a pick I can't sell myself on. Jordan Jefferson, LSU defensive tackle, number 116. So I gave it a D+. And my reasoning, it honestly has – well, I can't say it doesn't have anything to do with him as a player because it's basically about, like, his upside. But, like – so people kept saying the Jags took their – LSU's third best defensive tackle in the fourth round, potentially. Mekhi Wingo was a fan of many. He did go in the sixth round. I'd say Wingo was probably not even on the Jags board because of size and arm length. And the arm length threshold, by the way, I put this out the other day.
Yeah.
Mason Smith, Jefferson, Miles Cole. It's a predictor, right?
For sure. I think that. And then also a low-key one is – speed for cornerbacks. I think Balky really likes his corners to be fast, which is a good thing. So I think that's more of the low key one. Whereas like arm length for defensive linemen, like you got to have long arms or what's the threshold specifically? Like 32 and a half? 33.
He's taken 20 defensive linemen in his career and only four have had shorter arms than 33. And it's like Jay Tefele, a fourth round pick who you can probably say was an urban pick. Yasir Abdullah, which was a fifth round dart at the wall, and then two seventh rounders. So basically every significant defensive lineman he's taken has met that threshold, which means guys like, you know, Byron Murphy and Johnny Noonan were probably not even, if they were on their board, probably not very high. So I think it's definitely became a predictor. It's funny, somebody tweeted at me and was like, well, data actually shows that length isn't a very good predictor for a defensive line, but it is for corner. And you look at the corners, and they don't care at all at cornerback.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's interesting. But back to the Jefferson pick. So my entire stance on it is I think that he shows the film to be a solid rotational nose tackle. He's got a good first step. He's got the frame. He's really strong against the run. But he offers, in my opinion, less than zero upside as a pass rusher, which is why he's considered a rotational nose tackle prospect as opposed to, you know, like a starting one who can wreak havoc. So to me, I think he's an NFL player, obviously. And I think he makes sense as like I said, a guy who you use to spell your nose tackle on running downs and stuff and play maybe like 15, maybe 20 snaps a game. But I don't see the upside beyond that. I'm not sure he has starter upside. And I don't think he gives you anything in terms of pass rush. And that, to me, is why Jefferson was seen as like a sixth or seventh round pick on the consensus board and by Dan Brugler. It's not saying he's a bad player. It's just saying like his role in the NFL is very limited and it's not that valuable. To me, taking a backup nose tackle in the fourth round, even though they had a need for a nose tackle, to me is not very sound business in terms of efficiently using your picks, even if you have the need. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I said on our like pre-draft preview show that I definitely expected them to draft a nose tackle in the sixth or the seventh round. And Jordan Jefferson was definitely like a good candidate for that slot, but then they just drafted him a lot earlier. So that's what kind of why I was kind of thinking that, like, after they were able to grab Javon Foster two picks earlier, like, then it just became like undrafted free agency for them. And they were just getting all these non-premium positions. Cause I was saying earlier that like Mason Smith is a premium position player, but it's the opposite for fellow defensive tackle Jordan Jefferson. And so I gave this grade a C because, like, at this point he was the third LSU player taken. And I was like, clearly the Jaguars see something in all these LSU guys, and whether it's like genuine untapped potential and they're finding like diamonds in the rough, or if it's just blatant and dumb bias, like, I'm not sure which it is, maybe a little bit of both. So I just kind of hopped back on the fence, but in hindsight, or at like a day or two later, I'll definitely give it more of a, I'll probably just go with a C minus instead. Cause like it is round four. So like, I don't want to like kill a day three draft pick. But I don't know. I do think that this is going to be like the pick they look back on and regret. Cause Tanner Bortolini went the pick after to the Indianapolis Colts. And like, I don't know, Balky said multiple times during the offseason, like, they wanted to add physicality, they wanted to get stronger, this and that. And so, like, this should have been.
He told us what they were going to do.
Yeah. So, this was a pick that people should have seen coming. But at the same time, like, you could have gotten a nose tackle in the seventh round. And, like, if you're going to take, like, any position in these middle rounds, it should have been interior offensive line. Because I feel like that was a position in this draft that had, like, the most depth. And so, like, with Tanner Bortolini sitting there, and they. I don't know if it was a top 30 visit with them, but they definitely met with him in the pre-draft process. And so, like, I liked the Javon Foster pick, but I really would have liked to see them double down on offensive line and get one inside guy and one outside guy, kind of like they did with the cornerback position this draft. But instead, it was just a blatant reach. And so I was trying to go with a C to be nice, but now I'm realizing that that was actually nice.
I would have taken Mason McCormick, the guard from South Dakota State, or TJ Tampa. I wouldn't have taken Bortolini. I know most fans would have, and I'll tell you why. I think he can only play center. I don't think he has the strength to play guard. And I don't think there's a chance they were taking a center in this draft. Because, I mean, you realistically, they have two on top of the depth chart already, you know?
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
I do think that I would have taken either McCormick or TJ Tampa there.
Either way, I'm interested to see how the careers turn out for Jordan Jefferson and Tanner Bortolini.
Yeah, 100%. All right, moving on to their next pick. Fifth round, number 153, they took Ole Miss cornerback Teandre Price. I gave it a B. I think once you get into this range in this particular draft, it's hard to really kill many picks, even though I gave a fourth round pick a D+. And I'm standing by that one. But
yeah.
I don't know. I think Prince has really intriguing traits in terms of his speed. He ran, you know, 4.3, I think it was a 4.36, something along those lines. But he had one of the best 10-yard splits of any cornerback in recent combine history. And he has press coverage experience from Ole Miss. So, to me, it's like similar to, like, the Monteric Brown and Gregory Jr. picks of a couple of years ago. But he has more physical upside, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It's funny because a lot of pictures that we, the media, used after, like, Brian Thomas Jr. stories was one of Brian Thomas Jr. catching a fade route in the end zone over Deontre Prince. And then Prince brought that play up in his, Zoom media availability. But I'm with you. I gave this pick B-minus grade. But I'm, like, I feel the same way as you. I think it was the right type of prospect in terms of, like, offering enough athleticism at the position, especially for cornerback, like, where you really need to be athletic enough and mostly just fast enough to play. Is, like, it's not like any corners are really asked to, like, play on an island anymore, but, like,
yeah,
you can't get beat by speed every single play either. Like, it's also true that, like, no team plays like cover two every time, where the corners are just sitting in the hook or in the flats every single play. And so you definitely like need some speed and need some athleticism at the position. So I was glad to see that Prince brings some of that along with like SEC experience. B minus.
And like, there weren't many players who went immediately after him where I'm like, oh, the Jaguars should have picked him. You know, it was like Jeremiah Trotter, who stinks, a bunch of center prospects, receiver guys. They really, what I think the one person teams were fans were clamoring for was Muhammad Kamara, who went a few picks later. I think Prince is a smarter bet, man. Take the speedy corner over the undersized edge guy. He's literally has almost identical measurables to Yasir Abdullah. And Abdullah is probably playing linebacker for him now. So, and I can say, you know, for the people upset that they didn't take an edge, from conversations I've had with people, a big reason they didn't take one is because they had a lot of guys knocked down on their board this year because they didn't think they could be first and second down contributors. Because, like we said, this is such a small edge class and stuff. Yeah. They were not high on this edge class, it doesn't look like, especially as you get into day three, because it was too many guys who don't fit their profile. So I agree that they need edge help, but I'm not going to say anybody should complain over them not taking a Yasir Abdullah-sized defensive end.
The good news is, like, we'll see whether they act upon it or not, since they didn't last offseason, but the edge is usually, like, the deepest position in like the last wave of free agency. Like there's usually like a small handful of guys that could actually give you some decent snaps, whereas like by this point, like I feel like every other position is pretty much dried up. So maybe we'll add like a Bud Dupree or something like that.
And we have evidence of them valuing the business. Like even though they didn't address edge three last offseason, they did try to sign Jadeveon Clowney. As Trent reminded us, he chose a different offer. They tried to trade for several. They inquired on several other defensive ends. So they clearly knew they needed an edge three. I just think that they didn't really see it working out in this class, which makes sense. You know, they had needs that were higher than edge three. And once you get to the point where edge three is one of your most pressing needs, like you're in the middle of day three and nobody can actually play the position.
Pretty much, yeah. So,
yeah. So, all right. Fifth round, number 167, Texas running back / returner Keelan Robinson. So I gave this a C-. It's funny. You read his scouting reports, and almost all of them lead off with doesn't do much on offense, which is a running back. So it feels like, yeah. But I will say he's probably the best returner in the draft per my – push his glasses up – per my research. He's probably the best.
Are you Matt Miller now? Because that's the only person I've seen that said like anything about
read the beast.
I'm sorry. I know that Matt Miller called him the best returner in the class, and that's the only like returner take I've seen at all this time.
Then I retract it.
Okay.
It's an F.
I actually graded this a D, which I was surprised at looking back at. But I said, not every pick has to be a potential Pro Bowler, but like get like a slightly more better or more premium position. Like kick returner is something that like, again, is like more of a UDFA signing than even a day three signing. And so even if he is the best returner, like I'd rather them get like Miles Cole at this spot and then like just find a returner later.
I wouldn't draft Miles Cole in the fifth round.
I'm using Miles Cole as like just like
That's fair. If they had swapped those two, you'd feel better about it.
Way better, yeah.
Like I normally am skeptical when people say, "Oh, you could have got this player later," because I'm like, you basically don't know that at all. But I can probably confidently say they could have got Keelan Robinson later. But like you said, they're probably looking at the guys that they had highest on their board in terms of preferred undrafted free agents. I do wonder if we're going to start seeing kick returners go more and more in this range moving forward because of the new rules. I feel like I did a terrible job reporting the new rules because I had a ton of people say, isn't Duvernay the returner? And yes, he is, but you do need a second one now. You legitimately need a second one. And I don't know. people seem like killed it either because he's a running back or because he's just a returner. I get both. I don't think he's going to factor in much at running back. They frankly didn't even use the word running back when talking about him. They said returning is going to be his main responsibility, among other things, whatever other things.
It was key, though, that the running back tag was included in there just so Baalke could continue his streak. A running back selected in every single one of his drafts.
The best streak in the NFL. Mm-hmm. So I'm with this. Like a C-minus, I think, is about as low as I can give a pick in this range, and that's where I went with it. Yeah. I don't think it's a good pick, but I do. I understand if that makes sense.
Yeah, Baalke was asked. I want to say it was at the combine, but maybe it was just at the pre-draft presser about, like, it probably was the pre-draft presser about what the new kickoff rules, the effect that they'll have on roster construction. And he started out by saying, well, we're going to need two returners. And then later on, he said, oh, there's going to be like more linebacker type bodies on the kickoff, since like there's less running basically on the kickoff. You don't really have to get the speedier guys out there, and you can find some more muscle. And so that's kind of like the way I took it. So that's why I was mocking like linebackers and safeties to the Jags on day three. And then like paid attention to the whole quote, because he ended up taking kick returner 167th overall.
Yeah. I was surprised they didn't take a linebacker. I thought they would have, but yeah. I guess when you add in them taking a kicker and a kick returner, it kind of punches that out. It was clear that Heath Farwell was given the given the draft button around this.
Either way, for like both positions, like the expectation, I guess, was that it was going to be special teams contributors, though.
Yeah, 100%. All right, next pick, sixth round, number 212, Arkansas kicker Cam Little. So let me preface this. Like I said, guys, I'm with you. I definitely am. I gave this a C because I think the only thing worse than using a draft pick on a kicker is using a draft pick on a bad kicker. He at least seems like, from his college numbers and stuff, that he's a good kicker. But I'm with you. Don't draft kickers. I'm with you. Come on. Let's hear it.
This is like the reason that it's bad is because people like convince themselves that like, oh, but this guy's a kicker. This guy's different. It hasn't worked for them, but it could work for us. It's the Arrested Development team. And like, there's just been so many like research, analytic papers, whatever out there about how like kicker is an especially hard position to like just find talent at. Like, you thought getting quarterbacks was hard. Like, try to find a starting kicker. It's just, there's not a lot of guys out there that can last in the league. And so like teams will like convince themselves that they found someone who's finally an actually good prospect at the position, e.g. Cam Little. But I don't know. I get what you're saying, where like when you look at him specifically at the play specifically, it seems like he does have a good profile. Like, he had some clutch kicks and he's only 20 years old. And so hopefully he'll be here for two decades. But just like one of the biggest analytics rules of thumbs in the draft is like, just don't even waste a spot, because like there's such a low success rate of kickers that like it's not worth using a draft pick on one. Like, use a draft pick on a different position and then sign a kicker or three kickers in undrafted free agency and have them all try out for the team. Because like, yeah, it's just not worth the draft pick.
I feel like we'd be having a different conversation if they took him like with the Jordan Jefferson pick. If they did that, I think it'd be like an F- written in red.
Yeah.
I think it's easier to stomach two rounds later, I think.
I gave it a D, but like, since they were already treating this like undrafted free agency before this pick, and like, I don't know, it's a sixth round. Like, I think it's absolutely worth talking about and criticizing now this week, but like, I'm probably never bring it up again.
Yeah, no, I for the record, I don't disagree with you. I'm team never pick a kicker, never pick a punter. I think the worst pick in the draft, other than Michael Penix, was the Bears taking a punter in the fourth round. How do you take your franchise quarterback and a punter in the same draft?
Someone was telling me, apparently, like, the Bears actually had really big punting issues last year. Like, it cost them a couple comebacks. Exactly. Like, sure, but like, that doesn't mean going in the fourth round.
I nothing against the kid. I'm sure he's great, but I'm rooting against his success. I'm openly rooting for that pick to not work out, because that I'm with you. And like, when Tampa picked up the kid from FSU, that was obviously one of the worst picks ever, because That was them saying, no, this guy's different, you know, and obviously he wasn't.
Oh, no, I'd be flaming the Jaguars if they get something
like that. I mean, you're seeing kickers go like in the fourth round now. So I don't know. I was wrong. I didn't think Trent Baalke would pick a kicker, use a draft pick on a kicker in his entire life. So I got Baalke balled on that one. And
they did sort of survey the board kind of well, too, because I think there's two kickers, Will Reichard from Alabama, and then some other one that got off the board. And so then the Jags were like, we do need a kicker. Like, we don't want to go with Joey Sly into the regular season. And so might as well use the sixth rounder now rather than waiting until free agency. And so I do understand that a little bit, but even still, like, however much confidence you have in Cam Little is unfortunately probably way too much.
Yeah. So there are only three kickers drafted. So chances are after those first two went, they were like, we might not even get this guy in undrafted free agency since he'll be the top kicker out there. So I don't know. It is what it is. Next pick, last one, seventh rounder, Texas Tech defensive end, Miles Cole, number 236, a.k.a. the guy the Jaguars picked after a kicker.
it's there, Mr. Irrelevant.
Yeah, so, like, I love the traits. Freakishly long arms. I think he had the longest arm length and the longest wingspan of anybody at the combine. Tested like a freak. He looks like Tyree Wilson, basically, from, like, a traits standpoint.
Yeah.
The one small issue is he is not very good at football. That's the only reason a dude with his traits falls to the seventh, right?
For sure.
There's no other reason. I expect him to be a practice squad defensive end who they say, hey, maybe we can get something out of him with coaching. But he's certainly not ready to make an impact this year. His production and tape says that. Like, he's literally, they're starting from the ground up.
Yeah, I gave it an A grade because I was like, finally they got an edge player to play behind Josh Allen and Trayvon Walker. Because, like, we were talking at the top of the pod about how people are like, oh, but what if, like, a receiver gets hurt? Like, you can say that about every position, but for the Jags, I think it's like the especially edge, because if, like, Trayvon Walker, like, you know, I don't know, like, hits his fingertip or something, knocks his fingernail off and has to, like, get it taped up for a quarter. Like, that's a whole quarter of rotation that I'm not going to want to see. And so, like, I just assumed when the pick happened that Miles Cole would, like, certainly not be a heady contributor, but I thought he would, like, get, like, Yasir Abdullah type snaps. But now, after, like, a day or two, I'm with you where I think he's most likely a practice squad player and would probably only get called up if there was an injury or something.
And he's one of, I think, only two of their picks, so I don't really see a path toward playing time this year, which is an improvement from last year, right? Prince is the other one. I think unless there's injuries, you don't see Prince play defense. I think everybody else, you at least – okay, Foster, actually. Foster.
Yeah, I was, like, Prince and Foster are kind of sort of in the same range. Sure. But, like, Prince and Foster are also, like, fine for that because – and then even Cole, too, because they're all, like, important positions that, like, need to be addressed at some point, even if they're not – I mean, you could argue that they're major needs now, but even if you didn't say that, like, they're going to be major needs at some point. So it makes sense. Like, when we talk about, like, how the draft is just like a dartboard, like, I want the darts to be thrown at these important positions and then, like, use, like, the cheap knockoff darts later in undrafted free agency to get your kicker and your kick returner. But just, like, while you have as many darts, I want big swings.
Elite athlete at premium position, that's what you should be targeting in the seventh round, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So he like, to me, it's much better than taking, like, a Derek Parrish or a Raymond Vohosik in the seventh. Because there's at least something there traits wise. I mean, he looks like the most Trent Baalke prospect of all time, dude. I mean, just complete, he's like a Greek god in terms of measurables, but put him on the field and it's an adventure. So we'll see.
It will be interesting to see how he compares to last year's Mr. Irrelevant, because that guy was pretty irrelevant.
Who was it?
I think it was the fullback, right?
God, brother. Oh, brother.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all right. I'm not going to make my fullback in the second round joke. I'm going to be to myself. So I gave that pick a B. Overall, Gus, how are you feeling about the class? I'll start. I'm not going to disagree with those who are criticizing it too much, even though I'm a little bit of a fan of the draft. But I will say, I'm just using Trent Baalke's past drafts as context, not the rest of the league. My feelings about this class, walking away from it, compared to my immediate feelings in 2023 and 2022, I like this class a good bit more. I left the stadium last year. Like, what the heck did – what was that? The year before, I left the stadium, and I was like, wow, day three, they really kind of just lit on fire. I feel better about this class than I feel about the last two, if that makes sense. It's a lot of boom bust, but I can sell myself on more of these picks than I could the last two drafts. Last year, if anybody wanted to storm the gates after day two, I would have said that's an appropriate reaction. I didn't have that feeling this year.
I get what you're saying, and I think it's like fair to kind of point out that maybe there's some progress, or yeah,
he's growing.
Progress happening in the building, perhaps, but at the same time, like, is Gardner Minshew a good quarterback just because he's better than the two quarterbacks that came before him?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, just because you're comparing, like, a piece of crap to a bigger piece of crap doesn't mean the smaller piece of crap isn't a piece of crap. So, I'm not saying that this draft is a piece of crap. I'm just saying that, like, the perspective that you use could, like, kind of change how you feel about it big time. And so I think in a large scale context, I would give this a C+, mostly just for the first round being like getting extra capital and then getting Trevor Lawrence, like a cost controlled young weapon to grow with. So I think that was like a great round one. And then even though there was a few objective reaches in the second and third days, like I understand like taking the swing on Mason Smith. And, like, I understand prioritizing special teams, especially with the new rules. And so, like, everything was understandable. But I only gave it a C+ rather than, like, a B- or even a B. Because, like, the first two picks especially are just such big swings in the plate where, like, I feel like they're both – I mean, even just Mason Smith alone could, like, dictate how we're going to grade this draft in three
years. I was going to say, he probably makes or breaks this class, right?
And so, like, I just think that the fact that, like, it could sway in either direction by such a wide margin, like, I can't, like, get too far off of the fence. And so I think it was above average, but pretty close to average. So I'm giving it a C+.
I'll give you – I agree with C+. I won't disagree with that. C+, in general, B- by their standards?
I was B-flat by their standards.
I can work with that because I agree with everything you said. I think when you're the Jaguars, you got to take your wins and when you can. But I'm with you. I think Mason Smith probably makes or break this class because, like I said, they passed on so many solid players at that spot that that's probably going to be the pick where if he doesn't work out, people can say, oh, this guy was there or this guy was there, you know?
For sure. At the same time, if Brian Thomas makes three Pro Bowls in the next 5 years, then it's going to be a good class regardless.
That's a fair point too.
So that's,
I guess
they've got two just like big old swings at the plate. And so as long as one of them goes yard, it'll be okay. Fingers crossed for both.
Give me best pick, worst pick, most interesting pick.
Best pick, I'm probably like between Javon Foster and Brian Thomas Jr. So to make it not the first rounder, I would say Javon Foster is the best. Okay. The worst pick, I gotta stay with the take and gotta go Cam Little, the kicker.
Ooh,
that was the worst pick. I'm sorry, Cam Little. He seems like he's probably an okay dude. It's nothing personal, but like I said, these are like all more so based on the process than the players. And then the most. Go ahead.
If he works out, you have to buy him a beer. He'll be legal by then.
Okay. That's for sure. Most interesting pick. I'll go with Brian Thomas Jr. for that one. It just like is so good on paper in terms of like not just being able to catch bombs from Trevor Lawrence's big arm, but then also like he's in a good ecosystem to be able to grow from like really good veteran leaders in Christian Kirk and Evan Engram and Gabe Davis. And so I think the ceiling is the roof for him, but it'll be interesting to see what his development ends up like, because I know like there's like one of the potential red flags with his profile is that he didn't really have great college production until his final season. And usually with first round prospects, you like to see like good career production too, but he did like significantly improve as a player from 2022 to 2023. So I'm excited to see how that development continues.
So I did see one thread that I think is probably the one like thing to think about when it comes to this. I've said before, I think yards per route is one of the best like predicators at the position. Every good receiver, every good receiver in the NFL has a good, you know, yards per route. It says since 2015, there have been over 2,000 FBS receivers to leave college with a yards per route below 2.0, and that's not even like a high threshold. And Brian Thomas,
it's just career, right?
Yeah. And Brian Thomas was below 2.0, and of those 2,000, only two could be classified as non-bust, and that's DK Metcalf and Terry McLaurin. So if he hits, he will be kind of a statistical outlier, you know?
Yeah. I wonder, maybe this is just Cope, but I feel like it's probably a good thing that DK is one of those guys, because DK is a guy that he's like drawn comparisons to through the cycle of like, oh, he'll immediately be a sick vertical threat for you. But the question is whether he can actually round out his game and be more than that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think best pick was Javon Foster. I thought it was the best like mix of process and value and need. Worst pick, I think Justin Jefferson. Jordan Jefferson. I've said that like five times. I hate it. Jordan Jefferson. Yeah. And then most interesting pick, I'll go Mason Smith, man. I'm very interested to see what happens to that. Because like I said, I think he either is a massive hit or like you said, he doesn't make it past his first contract.
And I do think like similar for him, like he'll be able to like learn from Arik Armstead, Josh Allen, Trayvon Walker. They've got some pretty great coaches on that side of the ball now. And so, like, I think that it's pretty huge for both Thomas Jr. and Smith that, like, they're not expected to be home run hits right away. Like, Trayvon Walker was kind of
a million snaps. More
expectations. Yeah, because, like, he was playing so often and, like, was on such a bad team that he was expected to be good right away, even though it was really unfair to expect. But now we can, like, actually tamper expectations a little bit as Thomas Jr. and Smith are like brought along a little bit better.
Yeah. I'm with you on that completely. Well, Gus, you got anything else for us, my friend? Any takes to let off before we depart for the day?
No, I think I'm literally going to go outside and touch some grass. I need it.
Gus, I just want to say, I thought you did a fantastic job covering the draft for Big Cat Country. I am proud of you, and for 1010. I'm proud of you, as always, my friend, to see your growth in this field and growing your voice. And if anybody asks me, I mean, there, you know, two people that I think deserve every Jaguars fan's follow. That's you and my man Daniel Griffiths. So I just want to say kudos to you on a hard work job well done.
Appreciate that, John. Well, I've said this before, but definitely would not be here without you. So I'm excited to see how we both develop, how we both grow. I wonder how we're going to get graded. I don't know. Big things coming soon, though, to the Jaguar Report podcast theme.
Are there? You tell me.
Jaguar feed is what I was. Wow. I'm so brain dead, man. Yeah. Jaguar Report podcast.
Yeah. Anyways, I like seeing your brain melt in real time. With that said, remember to like and subscribe to us on YouTube. If you sub to us on YouTube, you guys will be the first ones to get the episode in the hour it takes me to post it elsewhere. So thank you guys. As always, we're almost at our 500 goal. So continue to sub. Continue to tell your friends, family to sub. And we'll be extremely grateful. But with that said, you got balky ball, buddy. Thank you guys for listening to the Jaguar Report podcast. What?
I know Quezzy did.
Brother. Yeah. God, you think he's climbed out of the locker you got stuffed into yet?
Absolutely not. He's still crumpled up there.
He is the least analytical GM of all time.
Right? Dude, he loves trading up. It doesn't make any sense.
Crazy.
It's wild. They've got about three picks in next year's draft. But, yeah, sure, that was a good trade. Minnesota.
He should be the first person the Jaguars call in round one next year.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so with that said, thank you guys for listening to Jaguar Podcast. We'll be back when we're back.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.